Brothers, goodbye. Dear mother and father, goodbye. My fingers are weak and I cannot write. Goodbye, Centralia, goodbye. It looks like the end for me and all of my buddies I see. We're all writing letters to children we love. Please carry our word to our wives. We found a little place in the air, crawled and drug ourselves here. But the smoke is bad and the fumes coming in, and the gas is burning my eyes. Dear sister and brothers, goodbye. Dear mother and father, goodbye. My fingers are weak and I cannot write. Goodbye, Centralia, goodbye. Forgive me for the things I've done wrong. I love you lots more than you know. When the night whistle blows and I don't come home, do all that you can to help Mom. I can hear the moans and groans, more than 100 good men. Just work and fight and try to see that this never happens again. Dear sisters and brothers, goodbye. Dear mother and father, goodbye. My fingers are weak and I cannot write. Goodbye, Centralia, goodbye.
Woody Guthrie, the dying miner. Her rallying cry was pray for the dead, but fight like hell for the living, and fight like hell she did. She was called an angel by coal miners. She was also dubbed the most dangerous woman in America. I'm Celeste Quinn, and this portion of the afternoon magazine, The Life of Mother Jones. Our guest is the author of a new biography of Mother Jones, Elliot Gorn. Mary Harris, the woman who would become Mother Jones, was born in Ireland in 1837, a few years before the Great Hunger. In the early years of her life, she saw tremendous hardship and survived great personal tragedy. These experiences steeled her, energized her. They made her the powerful union organizer she became for the United Mine Workers. Listeners, I welcome your questions for Elliot Gorn this afternoon. He is the author of Mother Jones, the Most Dangerous Woman in America. The book is published by Hill & Wang. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Elliot Gorn is professor of history at Purdue University. He joins us this afternoon from the News Bureau at Purdue. Elliot Gorn, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
What led you to write this book?
Well, I think perhaps most important is the sense that the memory of Mother Jones seemed to be fading.
Mm-hmm.
It was even fading with me. I remember in 1987 reading that her letters and speeches were being published, were being assembled and published. And I thought, well, Mother Jones, God, there must be an awful lot written on her, though I don't remember any of it, and I can't remember too much the details of her life, though I think I should know them. And then I went and started digging and realized that there wasn't very much that had been published on her, one rather slim and very critical biography of her life.
Mm. You write, the way Mother Jones lived her life was breathtaking. What's your favorite story about Mother Jones?
Oh, there's so many. I'll tell you a story that's not about Mother Jones, it's about remembering Mother Jones. I was in Colorado last summer, near where the Ludlow massacre took place, the famous incident, very similar to the song that that Woody Guthrie was just singing, where miners' wives and children dug into pits under the tents. The miners were on strike. They lived in tents. They dug pits to protect their families. When the miners ran out of ammunition during a siege by the militia forces, the militia came into the tent colonies and torched the tents, assuming everyone was gone. 11 children and 2 women died under the tents in Ludlow. Well, I was in that area last summer, going into the historical society where Mother Jones had been imprisoned during that time. Leading strikes was dangerous, and she often ended up in prison. An old woman who was the head of the historical society, I told her I was writing this book, and she said, you're writing a book on Mother Jones? I play Mother Jones in the schools. She would dress up and play Mother Jones. Then she pointed to her husband, a very elderly man, and said, his mother heard Mother Jones speak right out there. She said she never heard a woman swear so much. She, for people in the mine country, she still is a living presence, though the rest of us have forgotten her all too often, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, growing up, she never appeared in any history book I had in school.
No, that's true. And she was actually very important right here in this part of the country. This was Indiana, Illinois, Ohio was some of the most productive mining region in America, and it was the first major victory of the United Mine Workers. Go ahead.
I was just going to comment that she's just such a fascinating figure, and I knew next to nothing about her before I started reading your book. And she lived in this time of great upheaval from the Great Hunger in Ireland. She lived through the Civil War and, as you mentioned, you know, the minefield wars, the wars that took place in Colorado and elsewhere.
It is an amazing life that she led, for the first half of it, rather involuntarily difficult, with the Great Hunger. Now, if you read her autobiography, where she says she was born in 1830, you get no sense of the famine in Ireland. She doesn't talk about that. She describes her family as being rebels against the English. I found no evidence of that. And this is part of what you start to understand about Mother Jones when you study her, is that she created this character, Mother Jones. She was Mary Harris. She was married and became Mary Jones. But she created, when she was about 60 years old, created Mother Jones, the persona that would let her be out there as a woman, let her be out there on the picket line, at the podium. This is what really worked for her.
Yeah. When was she aware how she was, I mean, she was, I guess, aware, very aware of how she was connecting militancy and mothering, militancy and nurturance. She was creating this persona that involved both of those things, and the mother image let her get away with the militancy.
I think that's right. It's really, there are two basic sides to the Mother Jones persona. There is that really the sainted mother, and sometimes the martyr also, long-suffering, doing anything for her children, but also, again, the kind of martyr whose life is always threatened, jail always threatens. But at the same time, then there is really this militant matriarch, this woman who is an aroused mother, a working-class mother, and she's very clearly identified with that, with working a notion of working-class motherhood, fighting tough, taking nothing from anyone, and always willing to go to jail, to do whatever was necessary to win a victory.
Yeah. She became a legend in her own time, and she helped craft the stories about her that boosted her fame. Did she do that for the cause or for personal gain or both?
That's a very good question. There's no doubt that she enjoyed the limelight, that she enjoyed being famous and having influence. It was very important to her. Why shouldn't it be? Why should that be not important to her as it would be for almost anyone else? But she never lost sight of the cause and never lost sight of what her ultimate goals were, or I should say rarely lost sight of that. Anyway, she rarely lost sight of those goals. She was a socialist. She was a unionist, a militant unionist. And she believed, as many believed at that time, many. It's hard to imagine now in America, but that was a period, roughly 1900 to the First World War. It was a very, very militant time in America for labor. There were so many strikes. Workers were so oppressed in so many ways, and they knew it. They were aware of it. And Mother Jones helped them come together around issues. And that was finally her motive, was always to be out there, to be there as she would have thought it. It sounds rather patronizing, but out there for her people, her boys, her daughters.
Yeah, she would walk right into the mines.
Absolutely. People were really startled by this. Women were not supposed to be in the mines. There were even superstitions against it. But she would go right in, do her organizing, be right around the mine camps, be in places where there were armed guards who routinely beat up and even shot organizers. But she was fearless. She would simply go in and organize, this 60, 70, 80-year-old woman. It's really quite remarkable.
Yeah. And she organized other women, too. If there was a danger, if there was a strike and there was a danger that the company was going to bring in strike breakers, she got the women out there.
She did. She organized more men than women, certainly, and she really didn't believe that working-class women should be working outside the homes because she believed, and she was right about this, that their labor was exploited even more than men's labor. They were paid less, worked terribly hard. And the assumption was, the idea of the family wage, though she wouldn't have used that term, the assumption was that a family needs to be, women need to be, someone needs to be at home taking care of the family, and that was a woman's role, she thought, even as she is out there raising hell, that children should be raised to go to school, to improve themselves, to do better than their fathers, and that men should be paid a decent wage for their work, that labor had to be respected. And she believed that the only way that would be attained would be if workers did it themselves.
Hmm. Let's go back to her early life. You mentioned that she did not write anything about the famine in her autobiography. What is known about her family and their life in Ireland?
We don't know an awful lot, and you really have to dig for that kind of information. But we do know that she came from a working-class family in County Cork, that she and her siblings were baptized in Cork City, so that her family probably had already emigrated to the city when she was born. But there were ties to the countryside also, very recent ties, to Inchigeala Parish, which is about 30 miles northwest of Cork City. And there's reason to believe that the family spent time in both places, in the country and the city. Now, Ireland is a very, very poor place at this time, even before the famine. Tremendous, not only poverty, but underemployment. Too many people on too little land, people renting tiny, tiny plots of land, raising potatoes. It's a very, very poor life for the Irish. There are somewhere between 8 and 10 million Irish before the famine. When the famine hits in 1846 and they're up for the next 10 years thereafter, 1 million people die, 2 million emigrate. Ireland's the only country in Europe over the rest of the century that depopulates, that has declining population. So this is a very, very hard life, and there is a tendency sometimes to romanticize that life, but we have to keep it clear and in perspective. It's very, very difficult. So the famine itself sends her family on the road. Her father and brother first, probably in 1847, probably to Canada. So maybe the worst year of the famine, 47. People simply were not prepared for what was taking place. The one thing we do know is where the family lived in Cork, and here is this 10-year-old, 11-year-old girl. She must have seen this tragedy, the people pouring into the city, pouring in to leave if they could, to die, to go to the workhouses, to find charitable relief, whatever it was. She must have witnessed just unspeakable scenes in Cork, in the city of Cork.
So she's about 9-10 years old when the famine hits.
Mm-hmm.
How old was she when she left for America?
Probably about 13, maybe 14, and not for the United States. The family settled in Toronto.
That's right.
In North America. And the family stayed in Toronto. Again, her father worked for the railroad. You know, you get bits and pieces. You dig in. People like the Jones family, working-class families, are very hard to find information about. And yet we know from tax records and the census that they lived in a home that was 24 by 24 feet, not terribly large, 5 children, 2 boarders, 2 parents, remarkably cramped quarters. We know that, like many Irish families in America, they had livestock, chickens, cows, pigs on their land, in their backyard, a garden. It's those little details that give us a sense of life, of what life was like for people. Hard, but still reasonably, not prosperous, but making a go of it, doing all right. And then for reasons we don't know, she left Toronto when she was in her early 20s, went to Michigan, taught for a while. She had trained for a little while as in the normal school in Toronto, worked as a teacher in a convent school, then on to Chicago, and then on to Memphis in 1861, to Memphis, Tennessee. That's an odd place to go in 1861, before the war breaks out.
Yeah. It's also fairly remarkable to me, thinking about Mary Harris making all these moves as a single woman.
It was surprisingly not uncommon,
really,
for single Irish women to travel around a bit through a connection of families and the church to see a little bit of the world, to try to gain a competence in, whether it was as a teacher, she really was at the top of the hierarchy for Irish women, but also Mary Harris and Mary Jones practiced a seamstress's trade. She knew those skills also. Irish women did migrate around a lot and migrated by themselves before they married.
Very interesting. Okay, so she's in Memphis now, and she meets her husband, George, there.
George Jones, again, someone we don't know a huge amount about, but we know that he was an iron molder, a very skilled trade, that he was a member of the Iron Molders Union, one of the very early American unions, and a rather successful one, organized by a man named William Silvis, who had ambitions of organizing something he called the National Labor Union that would include, a little bit like the AFL in the 20th century, late 19th and 20th century, would be an umbrella organization for various trades. So we know that she knew about the union movement. The journal of the Molders Union came into the home. It was there. And then something happens that I think it's very buried in her life. She just mentions it in the autobiography. She returns to it a very few times in her writing, in her interviews, but really almost doesn't speak about it. And yet when she does talk about it, it's in very revealing ways. In 1867, she's a young wife and mother, four children. No doubt she was staying at home with the children. As a teacher, she wouldn't have been allowed in the schools if she was married and had a family. In 1867, one of those periodic waves of yellow fever, an epidemic, comes to Memphis. Not really a terrible epidemic this year, and yet it kills her entire family. Four children and her husband die within a week of yellow fever. This horrible disease, which the way people die is really very horrible to what people bleed from within and begin to hemorrhage through their mouth and so on. It's really horrible. And she watched that. She sat there and watched her entire family pass away.
Mm. Were Mary and George political people?
There's no way of knowing for sure, other than to know that he was a member of the Molders Union, and that at least at this fairly early date, this notion of the importance of a union of unions for workers was there. The seed was certainly planted. That's really all we can know for sure.
So now, what?
I'm sorry. Let me just say that. Certainly, she must have been familiar with the organizing of Irish. Especially, this is male mostly, but still, there was the organizing of Irish men to attempt to, one way or another, liberate Ireland, free Ireland from England, and that was out there.
So what radicalized Mary Jones? What pushed her in that direction?
I don't think we can know that for sure. There's just simply no answer to the question why one person and not another. Many people had hard lives, maybe not quite as hard as hers, but many people had them. And yet, some bit of education, some pattern of associations, her husband's being a member of the union, her learning about something about the union that way, and then these personal tragedies somehow made her see the world differently than many other people, made her attach her own grief and mourning, the poverty that she saw around her, and these tragedies that struck working people much harder than they struck the wealthy or even people of middling means, to see class as the explanatory thing that told her why life was so hard and how it could be made better.
Hmm. You write that for Mary Jones, a watershed event and a great turning point for her was the Haymarket riot of May 4th, 1886. What happened?
Yes, she certainly describes it that way in her autobiography, and it's hard to know. She was probably in Chicago at that time and witnessing it, though not really participating in it. Haymarket is a very important incident in the history of the American Union movement, American radicalism, and so on. In the Haymarket affair, well, basically, to put it very simply, during that time of Haymarket, the eight-hour day becomes a very popular movement among American workers, not only among radical ones, but among many, many American workers. This movement becomes led especially by anarchists, German and American anarchists, who are rather incendiary. May the 1st was to be a day of a general strike in many cities in America, including Chicago and New York, and literally tens of thousands of workers paraded on that day, May Day. Later, Mother Jones claims that her birthday is May the 1st in subsequent years. Following that, there's also a strike going on in Chicago at the McCormick Reaper plant, and these two movements come together in a series of rallies. A few days after that May 1st parade, there's a gathering in the Haymarket Square in Chicago. It's along Des Plaines Avenue. It's still there. There's really no memorial to it still outside. The last time the city built a statue of a policeman to commemorate the Haymarket affair, it was blown up in the 1960s. It remains, for many people, a very controversial affair because it was what probably should be described as a police riot. A bomb exploded amidst several policemen while this rally was going on, speechmaking was going on. No one knows to this day who threw it. No one has any idea who threw it. The police, though, responded to the bomb, which by basically open firing on just about anyone who was there. So there was a great deal of death, and more important than that, in some ways, was the rounding up of several of the most important leaders of the anarchist movement. They were quickly tried and hanged for being associated with this event, hanged for conspiracy. There is no evidence at all that they were involved in the throwing of the bomb, none whatsoever. Finally, those who were not hanged immediately, their sentences were eventually commuted by Illinois Governor John Peter Altgeld. Altgeld was politically dead after that. He didn't have a prayer of being reelected to office after that. This is a very important event for people like Mother Jones. They really see it as a moment when the true colors of the state and of business are shown, when any form of effort at reform, simply the eight-hour day, something we took for granted until a decade ago and probably no longer do in America, that the eight-hour day is something that workers must have. As workers like to say, 8 hours to eat, 8 hours to sleep, 8 hours to work, and 8 hours for what we will. Hmm.
Give us some idea of the tenor of the times. You talked about how Altgeld was politically dead after commuting those sentences. What was the attitude of the press, of the business community toward the socialists, the anarchists?
Much of the business community begins organizing its white-collar workers into militias and putting up the money to build armories in the city of Chicago, for example. And the press, the Tribune just celebrated its 150th anniversary very recently, and I like to think of it as 150 years of shame, but that'll probably make me some enemies. The press was very, very much, for the most part, not far from entirely, don't get me wrong here, was very much anti-labor and really stirred the pot in terms of the Reds, the anarchists, this kind of image of the bomb-throwing, insane, anti-American anarchist, really with Haymarket, is very, very widely propagated in the press. It's a period of tremendous repression against the left. Really, we've had, people think of the McCarthy era, we've really had a series of waves really of repression then in 1919 after the First World War and so on. So that was, I think, a very, very ugly time that way. But I think it's important to speak more generally about the conditions of labor in that era. This is a time when industries are consolidating, great concentrations of wealth, Carnegie first in steel, and then Carnegie bought out by J.P. Morgan, who created the United States Steel Corporation, capitalized at $500 million in 1904. These great concentrations of wealth that employ literally tens of thousands of people are creating terms of employment that can be extraordinarily difficult and impoverishing. Again, to stay with the steel industry just for a minute, men worked a 12-hour day in front of blast furnaces. Now, if you imagine the summer's heat on the shores of Lake Michigan, working in front of a blast furnace 12 hours a day, and then every 2 weeks the 24-hour shift, and you realize just how difficult these conditions were.
Elliot Gorn is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with him about his biography of Mother Jones. It's titled Mother Jones, the Most Dangerous Woman in America. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. So at the time of the Haymarket riot, Mother Jones is, well, she's not Mother Jones yet, but she's about 49, 50 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
So when does she hook up with the UMW, the United Mine Workers, and why the coal miners?
That's a very good question, and we don't have a certain answer. The UMW was founded in 1890, and she is with them shortly after that. We don't know exactly when, but it's sometime in the 90s and probably the first half of the 90s. Probably the reason she was attracted to coal mining, was because very quickly the UMW became the great, and this is with her help, the great industrial union in America. Not a craft union like most of the AFL unions, where workers are organized along the particular skills that they have, but a huge union of all workers in the particular trade, in this case coal mining, all of the men who do anything associated with the mines. And before long, when she first joined the mine workers, there were only 10,000 members, approximately. By 1903 or so, there's something like 250,000 members of the union. This is because of some great strikes and great job actions, including, again, here in the Midwest in what became known as the Central Competitive Field, but also in West Virginia and in Pennsylvania. Great strikes that Mother Jones was the leading, she was the leading organizer in these strikes. The most charismatic, the most able to stir a crowd. So even though she was limited as a woman, would never be allowed to rise in the union, in this particular union, this all-male bastion, as an officer, a president of the union, she was perhaps the single most indispensable person to the United Mine Workers until 1920 or so.
Hmm. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us. On line one, I'll call her in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. Well, I've got sort of a general question. You know, you're talking about the Haymarket riot. And about a year ago or so, I was reading an article by Andre Kudrescu, who had this notion to go visit Chicago, which had been the site of many important union strikes, riots, you name it, to find that, you know, if you didn't know what had happened from a history book, you'd never find these sites in Chicago. And I'm wondering, why is it that there's such amnesia about these events, which really are sort of important to all working people?
That's a wonderful question.
And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. That's a wonderful question, and I don't have a great answer. There is a general historical amnesia, I think, for many things that are difficult to think about, and there is a kind of need when you desire, when history is done in a popular way, it tends to be very upbeat history, and unfortunately, history is often a very sobering study, and we don't have much patience for those sorts of sobering things. But more specifically, the history of labor, the history of labor struggles that really have resulted in a much more prosperous working class, much better labor conditions as we have them today, many of the things we take for granted really have come from the union movement. And yet, I suppose, to be honest, because those in power and political power and economic power simply do not want to acknowledge that many of those struggles were first introduced and won through the power of workers themselves. It's a rather dangerous thing to think about. There's no doubt it's true that in Chicago, which was called the most radical city in America in the late 19th century, you would have a very hard time, unless, as you say, unless you know the sites themselves, you would have a hard time finding much marking of these places. The where the Haymarket martyrs were hanged, for example, downtown, you would have a hard time finding that unless you knew where to look. Des Plaines, where the riot took place, simply not marked at all.
Where were they hanged?
I don't remember. I don't even remember. It's a condominium now. I've been there, and I can't even remember the streets. It's North Loop area. But I can't. I can't recall the streets exactly.
Wow.
It's a few years ago I was there, and the first time I went to the site of the Haymarket, it was. This was about 10 years ago. At 2 a.m, drinking with a couple of friends, and one saying, "You've never been to Haymarket Square? You've never?" And there we were at 2:30 a.m. But looking at nothing, looking at a street.
Interesting. Back to coal and the UMW. Coal was absolutely critical to the economy. Give us some idea of the size and strength of the industry and its operators.
Coal is absolutely essential to the modern American economy. Something like 750,000 men mined coal shortly after the turn of the century. And you can't do the things that the economy does without coal. Trains run on it, steamships run on it. You build the great skyscrapers out of steel I-beams, and those are created in blast furnaces fired with coal. It is absolutely the indispensable fuel for the American economy at that time. 750,000 men working in the industry is a very large number, considering the population at the time is somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 million. That's a very considerable part of the population dependent on those 750,000 men. And yet, those men make in the neighborhood of $400 a year, except, of course, if their pay is much better in unionized areas. $400 a year is enough to starve on. It's why coal companies often located mills, textile mills, near mines, because there was a cheap source of labor, the wives and the daughters of miners, who would go into the mills to try to supplement the men's income to try to have a decent family wage. But it meant for a decent family wage, you would have the whole family working, and working at brutal, difficult jobs, extremely long hours, jobs that often crippled, paralyzed people, made them sick from black lung in the mines and brown lung in the mills.
Let's talk with another listener. On line one in Champaign County, good afternoon.
Yes, hello. I have a question for you. I had a grandfather who worked in the mines in the same time period that she would have been very active and in the mines in Illinois. And it was interesting to me, because of something I learned later, that none of these stories about this time period ever came down through the family. My grandfather never talked about this time period. And I only became aware of it as an adult by driving down I-55 south of Litchfield, which was close to where he lived. And I kept seeing a memorial marker that said the Mother Jones Memorial. And I drove by it many years and finally decided to get off one day, look at it, and then did some reading. And, of course, that's where she's buried, in a very simple cemetery there, along with some other miners. And I'm just curious, given what you told us about her family and where her husband and her children must be, how did she come to be buried in Mount Olive, and what do you know about this time period and how she got to be there? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thanks.
That's, again, a very great question with a lot in it. She chose to be buried at Mount Olive. That was the site, Mount Olive, Illinois, in 1897, of the last struggle to organize the mines in the central competitive field here in the Midwest. She was not involved with that. But when that battle was won, when the armed guards and the strikebreakers they were trying to protect to bring in to break this strike were finally routed, the United Mine Workers came into the Midwest. And finally, the mine workers, this is one of the ironies of that struggle, the mine workers really did a favor to the operators in the sense that they rationalized the market. There was no more cutthroat competition between the various operators. Miners were paid more. The operators made pretty regular profits, so long as the price of coal from elsewhere, West Virginia in particular, did not threaten constantly to undercut the price of coal coming from the central competitive field. Now, yes, that meant it was more expensive to use coal to make steel and so on, but it also meant that workers had more money in their pockets, more money to buy the things that they needed, and that helped the economy generally. Mother Jones chose to be buried there because that was one of the great struggles. Four members of the union died near Mount Olive in what was called the Verdun Massacre, and this is really the very beginning of the successful attempt to organize miners in America. When those four died in 1897, they were not allowed to be buried in any of the regular town cemeteries in Mount Olive because they were union men. The union bought what is still today the only union cemetery in America, the Union Miners Cemetery, and that's where they were buried, and that's where Mother Jones chose to be buried, near, as she said, her brave boys. But the larger question, too, why don't we know any of this, even in union families? I think part of the answer, just part of the answer, is that there is a certain embarrassment in America about labor organizing today. We don't find it in other countries. We don't find it in Canada. We don't find it in Western Europe, places that are much more heavily unionized, where it's much easier to organize unions. What we find is a sort of embarrassment because of the constant, and all I can call it, frankly, is propaganda against labor unions in America. You say the word union. If the word union comes up in the media, what always seems to show up is an image of a fat, corrupt, old politico-slash-labor leader. Certainly there has been corruption in American labor movement, but there's been much, much more than that.
Let's talk with another listener on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. On the issue of the monuments for the Haymarket riot, I could refer you to the WPA Guide to Illinois, which was first published. Hello?
Yes.
Yes.
Are you hearing me?
Very well.
It was first published in 1939 and republished in paperback in 1983. And that does describe the site of the Haymarket riot and also a monument to the Haymarket martyrs who were hanged, of course. And so, indeed, that memory was alive in 1939 when this book was published. So, on South DuPlain Avenue, near Route 330, the monument to the men hanged for the Haymarket riot is displayed. I suppose it's still there, but I can't guarantee that.
It's been moved indoors.
Oh, has it?
Yes, it was attacked many times because the monument commemorated the police more than the Haymarket martyrs. Though in Waldheim Cemetery, there's a very beautiful monument to those hanged in the Haymarket affair.
Well, thank you. This describes the two monuments as being separate, but you're saying that this one also commemorated the police. It doesn't say so in the guide.
That was what was put up by the city shortly after the affair. But there was a plaque there also now. Hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
On.
You're still here?
I was getting a little feedback. I'm sorry.
Oh.
In any event, yes, Waldheim Cemetery, though, is where several groups still sympathetic to labor do meet often annually on May 1st to commemorate the event.
I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon. We've got another caller waiting to talk with us. Before we do that, though, before we come to the end of the time that we can spend together today talking about Mother Jones, we have to know how she got her name, Mother Jones.
That's complicated also. And once again, we don't know for sure, other than that there had been a previous Mother Jones who had written for the Railroad Brakeman's Journal.
Mm-hmm.
She disappears when the brakemen when railroad workers are consolidated into the American Railroad Union. The first Mother Jones was a friend of Eugene Debs, and so was, of course, our Mother Jones. She seems to just take the name on, and some say that it was, in fact, the ARU, American Railroad Workers Union members, who give her the name. Whatever the source of it, it sticks. She makes it stick. She, by 1900, she doesn't write a letter that she signs Mary or Mrs. Jones. Everything is Mother. And by that time, also, everyone calls her mother. Workers, by the 20th century, President Woodrow Wilson, President William Howard Taft, to them, she is mother. To union leaders, she is mother. Everyone refers to her as mother. She insists on it, and they do it.
Let's talk with our next listener, who's on a cell phone on line four. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just wanted to point out to your listeners a great movie, which is an introduction to the subject, John Sayles' Matewan. I don't know if the author has seen it, but it deals with this time period. And I think Mother Jones is in it, but I'm not positive. And it's a great movie about a coal strike.
It's funny, I have sitting at my house a picture of Mother Jones right next to Sid Hatfield, who was an important figure in Matewan, in the event and in the film. It's a wonderful film.
Yeah,
absolutely wonderful.
I mean, people should, you'll really get a sense of what you've been talking about. Thanks a lot. Wonderful show.
Yep. Thank you for mentioning that. That is really a great film, just to get an introduction to this period in American history.
Mm-hmm.
John Sayles did in 2 hours what historians struggle to do in their books.
Something that puzzles me about Mother Jones is that she's so inclusive in her organizing efforts. She speaks highly of black miners and their families, but she opposed Chinese immigration. Now, she's an immigrant. How do you explain her opposition to Chinese immigration?
That was a very standard issue, especially among miners, but generally among working people. And it had to do partly with anti-immigrant feeling. California was virulently anti-Asian in this era. And this is a period in the 19th century. There were times when California's population was as much as 10% Asian. Part of it has to do with the circumstances under which especially the Chinese were allowed to come into the United States. They were not allowed to bring families or women, and it meant that they came in as contract labor. It meant that they came in often as very, very poorly paid labor, genuinely a labor force to displace higher-priced American workers or to undercut strikes and so on. They were very feared for that reason. Now, so there's a kind of blurring together of anti-Asian racism and the needs of unions to keep out competitive supplies of labor. So this is an issue that continues to be standard policy among unions, especially mine unions, well into the 20th century. And Mother Jones just simply supports that.
Yeah.
She doesn't spend much time on it. She doesn't say much about it, but she simply just goes along with it.
This is also another theme of the movie Matewan, where we have immigrants coming up with native-born miners, and they've got to build a bridge there between themselves in order to successfully fight for their... Or I can't remember how the movie ends now, but it's just as well I don't reveal it. But
yes.
You know that they've got to come together and join one another in solidarity.
You know, I remember the first time I saw the movie thinking that, boy, Sales is just a little bit over the top in this scene where the various musics blend, an African-American sort of bluesy harmonica and an Italian mandolin and so on. And yet, this is in West Virginia, of course, and yet, one, we have accounts from Ludlow in Colorado where that's exactly what was going on, that there were 20 different language groups in the Ludlow camp, and people were playing music together and blending musical traditions. And two, some of the instrumentation of what comes down to us as bluegrass music in the 1940s comes from these various immigrant groups. So the mandolin is a standard instrument in the bluegrass band, which is really an Italian folk instrument for many Italian immigrants. The banjo is a standard instrument, and that comes to us from Africa. There really is a blending of cultures here, and we should not think of the miners, and certainly not the people Mother Jones is organizing, and the American workforce, for that matter, as simply native-born American. It's very, very mixed group of people, racially, ethnically, by religion, and by gender.
Hmm. We're almost out of time. Before we go, I want to talk with you about her skills as an orator. While the priests of the church were calling on their parishioners to end their strikes, to go back to the mines, Mother Jones used religious symbols and stories to keep up the spirits of the strikers. She was very effective in that. I wonder, did she continue to keep her faith throughout her life? Or was that rhetoric?
I neither of the above.
Okay.
She certainly, when she died, she was given extreme unction, and she did have association with priests and so on. But when she was an organizer, she referred to all ministers and priests as sky pilots. This mm-hmm. was a sort of standard thing. Those who will take you through the sky to the hereafter. And yet, at the same time, there's a very almost apocalyptic sense to her organizing, and many others of the time, a sense that this is where solidarity is about more than just a few extra bucks per month. It's almost a religious kind of thing. It's about the real American patriotism, the real message of Christianity is about caring for each other, and caring for each other within a union. So this is not just simply a little bit, grubbing for a little more money. There's a real ideology. There's an ideology here that is not merely a kind of leftist politics. The labor movement sees itself as the bearers of the true Americanism and true Christianity. The left does have that heritage. It's something we forget today. We tend to let family values be associated only with the right. Mother Jones pitched her tent with family values.
Hmm. That's where we have to leave it. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Elliot Gorn has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. If you're interested in Mother Jones, look for his book, Mother Jones, The Most Dangerous Woman in America. The book is published by Hill and Wang. Elliot Gorn is professor of history at Purdue University. He joined us this afternoon from the News Bureau at Purdue, and our thanks to the folks there at the News Bureau at Purdue.